This is Wade Rathke with the Friday Morning Interview. We're very fortunate today to have Andrew Marcus, a film director who is presenting or is having his film presented at the Little Rock Film Festival, which is all in the news this weekend. Andrew Marcus's film is described as an edgy documentary by many people. It's about the career of Andrew Breitbart, the founder of many of the more conservative websites that got a lot of attention in recent years, big government, big Hollywood, big this, big that, who suddenly died of a heart attack a little over a year ago. The film is called Hating Breitbart. Andrew, that's an interesting title for a film.
Yes, well, thank you very much for having me on, Wade. I truly appreciate your taking the time to talk with me about this picture. We titled it Hating Breitbart sort of accidentally. We didn't intend to have a film that carried that title, but as we got to the end of our production after about 2.5 years, and we sat around trying to really take stock of what we had, and what became very clear as we were discussing our content was that what we had captured was a machine of hatred and vilification that was aimed at Andrew Breitbart, but by extension aimed at the conservative movement, the libertarian movement. It's aimed at, as far as my observation is concerned, at anybody who doesn't seem to have the progressive pedigree that's necessary to avoid the white-hot spotlight of vilification.
Well, there's a lot of hating going around. So, look, I want to get more into that. That sounds like a fascinating theme, and it'll be interesting for you to describe it. How did you get into this notion of doing these documentaries? What's your background, Andrew?
Well, my background is as a filmmaker. I went to film school in Chicago at the Art Institute, and interestingly, I went through film school at a very interesting time. I learned how to make films in an analog world, using 35-millimeter film.
Ah, the good old days, huh?
Equipment. Yeah, exactly. Came out of school and was immediately thrust into the digital age. I never touched raw film again, and the advent of that digital age really brought forth it was really the birth of the blogosphere and everything that was happening online that really attracted me. And I really wanted to experiment with combining documentary and blogging. And so I began just covering stories. I would create a blog just to cover a particular story.
So, oh, fascinating.
And when Cindy Sheehan was down in Texas, and I had heard that this was back during the Bush administration. And
yeah, I think Cindy Sheehan was wasn't she the mother of a veteran who sort of single-handedly was trying to picket outside of President Bush's ranch or something like that near Waco? Is that?
That's right. She was partnered up with Global Exchange and Code Pink and began a program of protesting outside of Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. Back during during his tenure during the Gulf War. And yes, Cindy Sheehan tragically lost her son Casey, and was moved to take part in this program of protest.
Well, you had a fascinating comment on the one of the websites for the film about having gotten attracted to filming protests because they were microcosms of human drama or something like that. But it was a very interesting cut. I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, Wade, I truly believe you take all politics out of it. You get more than 5 or 6 people together at any one place, and you've got the recipe for human drama.
that's true about everything, not just protest, I think, Andrew.
Right. That's exactly right. Well, and I didn't go down to Crawford when it was just Cindy Sheehan alone, because that wasn't enough light to attract this moth. But when I heard that, I think the group is called Move America Forward. It's one of the Move America Forward. Melanie Morgan.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with it, but I remember you know, Cindy Sheehan got quite a lot of publicity for a while. So
tremendous. Oh yeah, absolutely. And so I went down there when I heard that there were going to be counter protests going down. Now, as a filmmaker, that's drama.
Sure.
I have a high likelihood of capturing something interesting on my camera if I go when that's happening. So I just went. I created a blog called Lights, Camera, Protest, and went down there to see what I would find. And that really set me on a path that I can really draw a straight line from that experience to ending up filming Hating Breitbart. I got activated, Wade, and I think you can probably, you know, given your line of work, I think you can probably relate to this. What I saw there, I felt, was very disconnected from what was being portrayed. And that turned me on. That's a whole other level of drama. And that, you know, got me excited about covering protests and really taking a look at how they are, you know, how they're produced on the ground and what they really are in reality in relationship to how they're portrayed in the media.
So you were saying that the portrayal of the Sheehan thing was to one direction, but being on the ground, you felt like the footage you were getting showed another story.
Oh, absolutely. Well, look, I think that the media did a very good job of playing up the grassroots element of that protest. What I think that they did not do, and I think that this is probably because they don't want to lose their access and they don't want to not get the phone call from the protest organizers at the next event. They did very little to really document what was going on an organizational level in the background, and they were only telling the folk narrative that the protesters wanted told. Now, okay, fine, I have no problem with that message getting out, but I think that the media has a job to tell the full story. And what I witnessed was what was missing there. Again, the folk narrative of that protest was, you know, Cindy Sheehan and a handful of ragtag guys, ladies and gentlemen, going down there, sleeping in ditches, you know, just roughing it because it was just all they had were their bodies and they were going to make their point. Okay.
Well, I don't remember that the local Crawford people were very welcoming. I don't think they had much of a base of support anywhere near Crawford, did they?
Crawford, that's right. Crawford is a crossroad. I mean, it's barely a town. It literally is a crossroad and a set of railroad tracks. The protest area was 15 minutes outside of the crossroad.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was.
So they were out in the equivalent of an agricultural ghetto, huh?
Absolutely, there's no doubt. And
showing signs to each other and whoever had a video camera nearby.
Well, I think it was Bush's tactic,
yeah,
to take the press out to the middle of nowhere. It was punishment. And frankly, I think it backfired on him because when the Cindy Sheehan protest started, that was, they were like, okay, well, you brought us here.
Yeah.
It's happening, so this is all we're going to show all summer long. Right?
Well, that's an interesting point, Andrew. That is an interesting point because, you know, it's typical that they cordon off those kinds of things, but I guess it can go either way.
Oh, absolutely. No, I think that totally backfired on Bush to drag the media out there like that. But here was the disconnect that I saw. Yes, there was a grassroots element, and there was a folks element to what was happening, but there was also a tremendous organization behind it. You know, Cindy Sheehan, while there were some people sleeping in the ditch in weather so hot, I've never seen weather this hot, Wade.
Oh, I've spent time in Texas. I know what you're talking about.
The oil on the road separated in the asphalt. So when there were puddles on the road, it looked like a mirage. But when you got closer, you realized, no, that's no mirage. That's just a puddle of hot oil separated on top of the road. That's how hot it was.
Now, that's bad when a mirage can't be a mirage and actually is oil on the road. We once did a convention in Dallas years ago during the Reagan days, and, you know, we didn't have any choice. It was when the Republicans were having some kind of a meeting, and we were trying to, I forget what the message we were trying to get to Reagan, and we were doing the tent city. We'd had these Reagan ranches. This was many years ago, and it was 104. We were right outside, you know, in Dallas, right near whatever this little pissant stream is they call a river. Hot, oh, my God. It was like, You know, there wasn't a one of us who wondered why in the world we'd ever put people out in that climate. But, yeah, I can imagine Waco was, if anything, worse.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, but listen, Cindy Sheehan was not sleeping in the ditch.
I actually remember reading that somewhere.
Trailer.
Mission
trailer directly next to, and this was the other thing that sort of blew me away. They had a football field-sized catering tent serving hot meals all day long. All right? That is not cheap. You know that.
No, I hear you.
What surprised me, though, was that they had their own satellite truck, Wade. And they were putting out...
Oh, it wasn't a media thing? It was their own, just to get feeds up?
Their own.
Interesting.
Yep. It was their own. Now, look, if you're a student of the protest movement, which, Wade, I know you are.
Oh, absolutely.
Center.
I'm so glad I wasn't, these documentary digital things weren't around 30, 40 years ago, and, you know, God knows. You would have seen some raw stuff. It wouldn't have been satellite uploads, though. It was all hard rocks and low roads, but I hear you.
Don't get me wrong, Wade. I've got no problem with these programs of protest action. I just want some honesty in the way that they're covered. It's not honest to only cover the narrative of the protest. It's that's part of it, and you should cover that. But I think that if a protest is so well-funded and so organized that you have massive catering and satellite trucks, and
that's got to be part of the narrative. I hear what you're saying.
Was that? I'm sorry, Wade?
That should be part of the narrative, too. I hear what you're saying. I think that's right.
And so that's what got me interested in covering protests and interested in the media's relationship to the protest movement.
Well, Andrew, I think we can all agree that, unfortunately, the media has all become so lazy that whether it's, on the more conservative side of the line or the more progressive, nobody's doing any research anymore. It all depends on what hook the fish bites.
Wade, I would say that plays to the protest movement's advantage.
Well, I'm not surprised you would, and you know what? You probably wouldn't be shocked for me to say I think sometimes it plays the other way to the other side's advantage. But regardless, I don't want to get too far from your film
right, okay.
Because, that's what we need people to know about. So let's look at Andrew Breitbart. He was a bigger-than-life figure, and you stumbled. How did you stumble onto him from Cindy Sheehan to Andrew Breitbart? What was the bridge you crossed there, Andrew?
Okay, so from Cindy Sheehan's protest in Crawford, Texas, I began covering every protest I could get in front of, whether it was Ward Churchill coming to DePaul University or the anti-war protests or when they began to sprout up the Tea Party protests. And I went and covered all of them the same way I would cover anything. I mean, like I said, you get human beings together. You've got humor. You've got drama. You've got all of that there to be had.
Well, in those early Tea Party protests, you had action. I mean, you had people jumping up and, yelling at congressmen, and you don't get that every day from anybody.
That's absolutely right. And they were marching. When was the last time you ever heard of conservatives marching or libertarians? They just don't do it, and we're doing it. But what I noticed was, I saw this glaring disconnect between what I was witnessing on the ground and what I was seeing portrayed in mainstream media. And this time, it wasn't just a matter of dishonesty. I got to tell you, this time I was actually horrified by what I was witnessing. Because, and I've got the footage to prove it, I was on the ground for the first ones in Chicago, the first two in Chicago. And what I witnessed were people who were furious about, and I'll tell you the number one thing that it was they were furious about. They were furious that the TARP bill passed without anybody reading it. And that was, it's not like that's the first time a bill has passed with nobody reading it, but for some reason.
Yeah, I think that's a regular thing, isn't it?
Right, well, and this time it resonated for people. Like, it was so big, and it was so important to Bill, and it was such an emergency and such a crisis that we were left in the situation where nobody read this bill that they voted on. It was so glaringly obvious that was what I think fueled the outrage that I saw on the ground. And they were terribly upset about spending. They were terribly upset about the rolling wave of democratic socialism that is overtaking this country. And they could, while they couldn't necessarily put a name to it, that was definitely what they were outraged about.
But, of course, even on the other side of the line, there was huge arguments around TARP and its bailout of the banks, right?
Absolutely. Oh, there was outrage.
So, I mean, that was an area where, had somebody been trying to figure it out, there probably was a common cause somewhere out there.
I suppose. But
I mean, remember, that was in the Bush era. That was pre-Obama on TARP.
Right. That's exactly right. No, that's exactly right. No, and this is why it all...
So it's hard to accuse President George W. of, you know, leading the move to social democratic tendencies or something.
No, they would. I think they would argue he absolutely was going that way because his domestic spending priorities seemed very progressive. I don't think there was a spending bill that came out of that Congress he didn't sign. So that was very upsetting to people. Look, at the end of the day, what this movement was a movement that was reacting to a wave of what I identify as democratic socialism, okay? And most people don't even know what that means. They don't even know what democratic socialism is. But I think if they were to educate themselves and take a look, that's where we're headed. And
well, give people a short definition for the listeners here.
25
words or less.
You know, I grabbed mine from the Democratic Socialists of America, one of the partners in creating the New Party, Working Families Party, groups you're all familiar with. When I read through their platform, I would be very hard-pressed to give you an encapsulated definition of it. I would just recommend going to the Democratic Socialists of America website and read their platform. It reads like what's been happening.
But normally you hear people refer to that as sort of a European, the way some European countries are run. So, I mean, that might be helpful for people.
That's where they take their model from. That's right.
Yeah.
What I witnessed on the ground at the Tea Party was what I've just described to you, this outrage about these things. And the way that they were portrayed in the media was racist, potentially violent, just angry that there's a black man in the White House, all right? Now, that horrified me. I was witnessing the devastating effect of our mainstream media just not being honest. This was maligning an entire section of Americans wholesale. And I was raised to believe that was absolutely wrong to do, to make base value judgments about whole groups of people. I was horrified by what I saw, especially because the media has this vaunted position of being the gatekeepers of truth and news and information.
So I'm guessing that part of what then drew you to Breitbart was that he was also a gadfly super critic of many of the dominant media practices, right?
That's not, I think I bonded.
I keep trying to get you back to your film, Andrew.
Right.
I'm just trying to help you here, brother.
What did it? We're getting there.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking this, man. I do. The reason that I ended up noticing Andrew Breitbart and being attracted to telling this story was that, and this is where this may get a little bit close to home, Wade. He had just released the James O'Keefe Acorn videos, and it was September 12, 2009. It was the first time I ever recorded Andrew Breitbart on my camera, and it was, again, because I was recording the tea parties. I was in Quincy, Illinois, for their tea party, and I noticed something. I noticed that Andrew Breitbart, who was under vicious attack for those videos, I don't know if you remember, Wade, but he was accused of being racist for publishing those videos about Acorn. He was under terrible attack by what I saw as very much the same attack that the Tea Party was suffering by the same perpetrators at the same time. And so I was attracted to Andrew and his story because I thought that it absolutely intertwined with what I was witnessing was happening to this movement of people in the mainstream media. So I really felt that by telling his story and documenting what was happening to him I was really using that as a vessel to explore what I saw happening in the mainstream media. And again,
well, give us a sense here, because his public persona, and certainly in that time, I'd left Acorn in 2008, so that was a year later. And boy, I can remember the first call I got. I was in Toronto at the time, and I said, "Hey, you know, they don't even have television up here. I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know what these videos are." And you know, obviously, when I came back, the controversy was swirling. But as I remember the way Breitbart came off, it was like a guy who loved a good fight. You know, not a happy warrior type, but you know what I'm talking about. Somebody who was throwing as good as he was taking and was banging on the door. Is that different than what you really were finding? Because that sounds a little bit different.
The way he described himself, and this was, I thought, pretty accurate in terms of what we captured, he said he had two modes, righteous indignation and jocularity. And I really think he had both on tap at any moment. He largely existed in the jocular. He was usually joking, usually not talking about anything having to do with politics. He was, you know, his loves were baseball and 80s music. And he was, you know, even the people who met him who were absolutely diametrically opposed to him politically came away saying, "Wow, I really like this guy. He's not what I expected." And I think part of that is because he was so vilified that once you met the human, you realized, wow, well, he's not exactly the caricature that's been painted of him. But yes, he did not shy away from the fight. He was always, you know, getting into the scrum because that's what he felt was needed.
Now, wasn't he one of the, I don't know, maybe co-founder is not the right word, but he was definitely there at the very ground floor of the Huffington Post, yeah?
That's correct. Andrews,
which has a reputation as, you know, one of those kind of super liberal voices out there.
Kind of Daily Kos, but it's but not by much. That's, you know, and really that was right in line with his philosophy because, again, he used to say nobody would really believe him. He used to say, "I'm not political, I'm not political."
Yeah, I wondered if he really was political. I mean, he was trying to build a business.
Right.
You have to move traffic. I mean, in some ways, I think if somebody, you know, thrown a piece of video into his lap that had some super conservative, doing God knows what, losing his shoes in public or who knows what, I'm not sure that wouldn't have been on big government, too. Is that wrong? Or
He would have trumpeted it from the rooftops. He absolutely would have because, again, his whole thing was, and he used to say this, more voices, not less. You know, he just got off on being able to, you know, create these megaphones and use them. He definitely, you know, again, he had massive political effect, but his whole focus was the media. And this was where we bonded, and I'll be very honest about it. I definitely bonded with him over this.
Sure.
You know, his outrage at the mainstream media just simply not doing his job. And that it has a real effect on our lives. It has a real effect on our system, and it's a corrosive effect over time.
Well, I think part of what's always difficult here is if you're building, in a digital age, as you pointed out, Andrew, if you're building a platform in that age, and that's definitely what Breitbart was trying to do. He had a history of doing it. He was very successful and good at it. There's a lot of crowded voices out there, so you have to somehow beat a drum if you're going to have people find where you are in this vast corner of sound that's out there. And so that's why, you know, at least my reaction to him was never anything other than, you know, here's a pretty smart business guy. I think where he got caught was sometimes it was less than transparent. I mean, when he was in the center of the storm, I think he denied in the beginning that he had any financial relationship with say, O'Keefe in the videos. And later ended up sort of retacking the ship and indicating they had paid something for the production or cost. Or is that correct or wrong?
Well, I have no idea if there was
a... Yeah, and I only know what I read, and you know, I read it in the damn media that you're talking about.
No, I'd be happy to get James. I'd give you James's phone number. You can ask him directly. We can dial him in.
Well, it's a matter of public record now. I mean, it's been well publicized. I mean, both O'Keefe and Breitbart, before he died, indicated that, yeah, he'd gotten money for his time and effort.
Wait,
it's just Andrew Breitbart said he didn't pay for it on the front end.
I don't think that Breitbart paid for the Acorn tapes to be produced. That's
right.
Sure.
I think he offset the cost after they were done. Or I forget how he framed it, but it was more an after they were presented, he encouraged them to go forward.
Is that anything different than what a freelance journalist would get from any organization that they shop a story to?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. What would you feel?
I don't think that it is. I think that's how freelance gigs tend to work.
But I think Breitbart was very clear he didn't want any of the liabilities that went with Bill Keefe's operation. I know when the Landrieu thing was big in the news in New Orleans, where they'd had a four or five of them, I can't remember how many. I know O'Keefe was part of that crew, or somehow trying to get into the telephone system in the federal building where she had a field office. Is that wrong? I mean, they actually pled out on that issue, but if that's wrong, correct me.
What did he plead, Wade? Wade, what did he plead?
You tell me. I thought he settled that an admission there. Is it one of those no contest?
Again, I wish that there was a way that we could. I would give you his number right now if you could dial him in so that he could explain it himself. My understanding is he pled to a misdemeanor, which was wildly misreported that he had pled to some felony. He's still...
Well, you know, I actually read the New Orleans papers. That's where I live. So I know it was a misdemeanor, right? I thought he made a good deal.
Right. Well, no, but what he was accused of, and again, this gets to this machine of hatred. And look, I don't think this is exclusive, just aimed at the right. I think it happens all the time.
Oh, yeah, we know a lot about hating on the left, too.
Right, no, there's plenty of hatred to go around. I recommend anybody...
I mean, you yourself right now are talking to the Antichrist.
Make a film. Yeah. But what happened to James, again, is a perfect example, because he was arrested. Before he had even had an opportunity to contact his attorney, the FBI was leaking bull crap about what he was involved in and what happened to him. The FBI. I would imagine you can understand the FBI misbehaves that way sometimes, right? You guys are...
I think that's their standard operating procedure. So, I mean, anybody who's going to be active in the public sphere has to know that it's a hard game out there.
But because of all of that, he was lynched. He was lynched. James O'Keefe was lynched, man. I mean...
Well, but he was sort of caught in a... It's hard to explain the situation he was caught in. I mean, that's not exactly walking down the street in the French Quarter of New Orleans.
No, but it was not wiretapping.
I understand it wasn't wiretapping. But, it wasn't the smartest thing probably James ever thought he did.
Well, listen, again, I don't want to speak for him, and that's a completely valid question for you to put to him. I hope you take the opportunity to talk to him. And again,
sure, email me later. I'll reach out for him.
You can dial him. Do you want his number?
Not on the air, but, you can email me later. And look, and that reminds me, I want you to tell people, do you know where the film is showing here and when?
I do. Wade, you're very good at this. It is at the Market Street Cinema in Little Rock, Arkansas. You can also go to hatingbreitbart.com and see everywhere we're playing. We are also today released on iTunes, Amazon, Netflix, all the major VOD. You can find us everywhere. So if we're not in a theater near you, you can get online and you can find this film.
Well, I know people in Little Rock, obviously that they have a long attachment to Acorn. Haven't been founded there in 1970, so there's probably going to be interest in seeing how it goes. But what are you? I almost know the answer to this question. I haven't spoken to you for a half hour, Andrew. But what are you hoping people take away from Hating Breitbart as a film, a story of a man's life and work, as well as some bigger issues about media, I think.
There are a few takeaways. I think probably one of the most important ones is to open people's eyes that the caricature that they get of people in media and of movements in media is flawed. A, it's flawed because the medium only allows you a very short amount of time to tell any story about anybody or anything. But also that there is active dishonesty at play. And it's dangerous, and we're losing our republic because of it, frankly. I think that's an important takeaway, that people need to realize that there's a racket going on, and it's incredibly dishonest, and it's incredibly damaging to innocent people. I think the second takeaway is that the era of monopolized narrative on behalf of the mainstream media is coming to a close. It's not dead yet, but it's absolutely coming to a close. And Andrew Breitbart was a champion of this. What he knew was there was a revolution in two things, acquisition and distribution. On the acquisition side, everybody's armed with cameras now.
Yeah, it's going to be a different world. And I've been lucky for the last half hour to have Andrew Marcus with me, the director of a brand new film, a documentary called Hating Breitbart, which is one of the many features at the Little Rock Film Festival. And as Andrew Marcus has indicated, it's going to be perhaps showing in a theater near you. This has been a fascinating conversation. Andrew, best of luck, and thanks for your time. And I'll look for that phone number later.
You take care.
Thank you. Bye.